invest in research, invest in understanding the users that you think want to interact with your products and services at a really textured micro level, because you get huge upside from that.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. If it's your first time here, welcome. If you dream of being an entrepreneur or you already run your own business, you're in the right place. This is the pod for you. Every week, I chat with incredible entrepreneurs and find out what experiments help them build some of the world's best companies. And today, we're talking digital. I'm talking to John Mitchell, the CEO of All Human. So All Human bridge the gap between the physical and the digital. They lead the digital transformation and projects for some of the world's biggest companies. So they are how you interact with some of the best known brands you interact with on a daily basis. It's an incredible chat. We talk a lot about trends, and I love trends. We talk a lot about the blend of digital tech and real world and how companies can bridge that divide. John makes a huge prediction that the reckoning is coming for companies that don't adopt digital or have a digital strategy. So if that's you, listen up. You're about to save yourself a whole lot of pain. First, I want to say a quick thank you to my sponsor for 2022, Sage. As an entrepreneur, you need to be leveraging tools and software to run your business as smoothly and efficiently as possible. That is why I'm delighted to partner with Sage for this season of the pod. Sage is the global market leader for technology that helps small and medium businesses perform at their best. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description. John, welcome to the pod.
Nice to meet you, Gary. Thank you for the invitation.
You're very welcome. It's great to catch up with you. I have to start off, that is a very cool piece of art you have behind you.
Yeah, it's a, I'm not sure this is going to be featured on your podcast, but yeah, it's a skull designed by a Aussie. I think he designed it for a beer brand back at home. He's obviously of Irish extraction. His name is Jim Kelly.
I love it.
I saw it at the charity auction, picked it up. Sometimes it scares clients, but I like the fact that it's vibrant color, you know.
It draws your eye anyway. I'm like, because we're painting the house at the minute, and I'm trying to find like cool little bits of art and stuff. I'm suddenly starting to tune into what people have on their walls. It looks like if someone broke in, they wouldn't know who lives here. It's just all bare walls. It's like vampires live here.
It's nice to have a bit of pop of color, you know, and you don't want to. Sometimes you have these backdrops you see on these, you know, contemporary Zoom calls that can be everything from a messy backdrop of someone's bedroom to some sort of amorphous sort of backdrop that's computer coded. So yeah, try not to be stating what I like about it is it's bright.
It's cool. It draws the eye. Welcome to the pod. What is it you guys do?
So we are we're a company in change mode really at the moment. We design and we build digital products that create growth for companies. And I suppose what we do that's slightly different is that we do a huge amount of spend a huge amount of time in really unearthing what real people want before we go and do anything. And that's a new space that we're finding is very I suppose it's a bit of a mashup, Gary, in that we as a company, our genesis would have been, I'm going to give you a long-winded answer here, I'll try to be as abridged as I can, but we would have been a classic web shop designing and building websites and apps for guts of 15 years. And about 5 years ago, we started to get really interested in analytics and what was happening, you know, as they say, under the hood.
Was there something that you saw that kind of was like, wait a second, things are changing here, or was this a gradual shift?
I think one of the things that we copped on quick enough was that, you know, in order to improve whether it's a website or an app or a digital experience or an e-commerce shop for a client, we just needed to be a bit more professional, right? So you really need to take the subjectivity out of it and what you can do with a variety of tools from products like Optimizely to Google Suites. And there's a whole plethora of them out there that we use. You know, you can start to be very, very objective and kind of let the algorithms, the maths tell you exactly what's happening. So I suppose 5 years ago, we started really inexorably invested in we picked a bit of the bright sparks in our firm and we brought them together and said, right, guys, just go and do your thing, and kind of took it off the clock. It was a bit of a leap of faith, really. And so we took an analyst who purely crunched numbers in terms of ascertaining what users were doing, look at all the I suppose, the breakages and all of the kind of fall-offs. And then we put that person with a designer. And then we put those two people together with a developer, and then another analyst joined them. And they kind of created this little subcult internally. And from that, they just said, well, you know what? Let's just start running experiments. Let's start trying new stuff and then testing that and see what happens, and just be really empirical about it. And that was really the foothills of it, Gary. And from that, then we developed this team that we called the digital performance team. And so what they became really proficient in was really optimizing all of the things that you want users to do on your digital channels. Right now, you know, if all agencies, if they're honest with themselves, always miss things at design stage. Clients always kind of make the wrong assumptions. Sometimes they assume the right placement of product or pricing, or the customer's wrong. There's always guesswork at some point. So what we found was that this method was allowing us to come back to clients and really help them with things like their conversion rate. And if you can imagine, for high volume, you know, significant e-commerce channels, we talk about like hundreds of thousands of millions of income going through these flows, that pure percentage game is really has a trickle down into the bottom line. Okay. So that team has grown, and we became, you know, hyper certified, and, you know, started winning awards and started doing some really cool stuff, like, as I said, increasing conversion rate and growing revenues for clients. And
had you given them a brief to go into a whole new area? What did you kind of tell them to do to kind of hive them off, to kind of get them out of the box of going, okay, we're a web design agency? What did you ask them to do, or did you ask them to do anything? Just give them carte blanche?
Well, it was very much framed in a business language. And, you know, we're guilty in our industry of a lot of jargon, a lot of techno babble, and it becomes pretty indigestible. So, you know, I come from only a banking background. And what we wanted to do was kind of a John Major way, maybe you're old enough to remember him, but get back to basics. And, you know, when organizations invest, particularly evolved organizations invest in digital, they want a return on investment, right? So the answer to your question was, we said to this team, what we need to do is have very compelling improvements and optimization strategies that will grow revenue and build business and give the clients who've invested in many cases, very significant expenditure, digital marketing. You know, a lot of organizations in B2B or B2C, you know, household brands and retail, tourism, e-commerce, spend a huge amount of money on attracting traffic to the shop front. And quite often, the traffic that arrives at the shop don't go into the store, to continue with the analogy, and they don't take the stuff off the shelves, and they don't put it in the basket and check out. So we call this the leaky bucket, you know, it's quite eye-watering to us when we look at a lot of very evolved organizations, really, you know, in many cases international names, you know, the level of expenditure that they're investing on generating traffic is not washing through to a return on investment or a justification for that investment. So that's where we started to lean into. So the brief to the team was, use your design, use your experimentation to see where you can grow these channels in a really business purposeful way. Okay. And that took us into conversations, Gary, where, you know, we started talking, you know, kind of at a CMO level. We started talking to kind of C-suite and saying to them, this is what we're seeing on the live products. This is what we're seeing in the real world. Now, what we're also asking ourselves is, are these the right products that will allow your organization to live and exist into the future? We don't know, you don't know, right? But we were starting to be asked really, really, I suppose, existential questions. You know, how do we build brand loyalty and grow revenues 3 years out, John and team? And we started to ask the questions, well, who's your target user? How have you done the segmentation? How have you researched them? What are your assumptions around the profile of the personas or the customer profiles that you've assumed want to buy these products? And again, you know, I'm not trying to be controversial here, what we witnessed was shocking, quite shocking, you know, the level of really, really average assumptions and very much out-of-date assumptions. Quite often, persona types like the stressed 30-something or the aspirant 20-something looking to get onto the foothold into property, or the traveler looking for an experience. You you know, all the descriptions for these types of customers would look really, really the same, right?
I'm hearing all the generic bank ads in my head as you talk.
Yeah. So you know, if you're, you know, there's three or four current account providers, if you're a fintech or if you're an insurance provider trying to break into new cohorts, the type of customer profile that you generally work off as a script is very vanilla, right? So that's fine for the kind of middle of the bell curve, but if you're looking to kind of carve out brand equity in the future in digital, that's not going to cut it. So what we were starting to kind of realize was, okay, so we're seeing how you can improve products in a live environment. How can brands navigate the future and create points of differentiation that can be a real hook for them to retain their distinctiveness and their uniqueness in what has become a very commoditized place, right? Particularly with the advent of the behemoths like Amazon and Google, et cetera, right? Where search derives everything and the conflation of e-commerce. So if you're selling product or you're selling a service or you're selling financial services or insurance or travel or tourism or, you know, whatever it is, what does your brand look like in 2 or 3 years time? So what, where that took us, Gary, and I know probably I'm being very long-winded here, but where that took our team was, let's start looking at some kind of classical market research. You know, let's look at things like segmentation. Let's look at things like surveys and primary research. And let's ask users, are these the products that you think you might invest in? And that took us into a really interesting place. So that basically took classic marketing methods combined with our digital performance team. And that kind of came together in what our kind of core process is. And we call it people power performance, just to be revolutionary about it. And it's all back to really asking users, before you invest in a digital initiative or a product or a journey or an app or a website, ask them. And try within that asking to try and find out where your brand can lean into and where you can start to garner interesting insights. So you may, you know, we find some remarkable stuff in the, using this kind of approach. It's not radical, it's just systematic. You know, organizations that would have made assumptions like older cohorts of buyers that would just not want, they would assume would not want to be digitally engaged. Mm. But actually the value and the return investment on that segment is vast. So, you know, there's loads of aha moments and that, you know, within that is kind of where we've evolved as an organization. And then obviously, because we've been building and designing for so long, we can stand up these concepts quite quickly. So, yeah, that's a very that's kind of what we do. We research real people. We test products in the live environment. But overarching that is business growth in a digital context. And money and return and commercial success for clients.
I love it. The best stuff's always the simplest, though, right? That's always the key. You can get as complicated and as deep into it as you want, but it comes back to simple people behavior. How did this all start, though? You mentioned your background there a little bit. How did this all get going, though?
Yeah, well, I'm not a founder. The business has been trading for 20 years. I came back from the US, worked in banking, worked in as an analyst. So come from a different world, was pretty attracted to the, I suppose, the creative aspect of digital and agency life, completely as a fluke. I linked in with some of the guys at the IDA when I was in the US, and when I came back home for a brief period, I was approached by somebody who was a principal in this company, which is called Strata 3 at the time, to say, would you be interested in taking over this company and invest in it? And it was quite a distressed company at the time. And yeah, it was a hard decision, Gary. You know, I just, you know, left Wall Street to join a small agency in Dublin in the early 2000s, late 99. It's a bit of a shift, but no regrets. Yeah, it was it was something where I had the chance to really put my own stamp on it and grow a team organically with one or two really, really valuable colleagues. So that started back in, the company was incorporated in 99. I invested in 2002. After 9/11, because I subsequent to the banking got involved in the payment technology, and that all went crunch after 9/11. Pretty much from 2002, we built the business up, kind of getting close to kind of 100 people in the business. We do very significant work for banks and telcos and for energy companies and insurance companies, and work with the likes of Fault Ireland and Post. We transform these organizations, and what organizations kind of see us now as really nimble, really smart, kind of alternative to the big four. We come in with really strong heritage in design and build, but we bring in that kind of human-centered research to kind of make clients really sure-footed as to where to go.
How did you make that leap, though, John, from going from Wall Street, which I imagine is a very, very, very different culture, to coming back to Ireland, first of all, and then becoming essentially the head of nearly a new company? How did you bridge that? How did you make that mental leap from one to another?
I suppose just not to portray myself as completely entrepreneurial. The company pre-existed, so it was an opportunity to buy in at a kind of attractive level. I also had the option of a sabbatical with the role I had, so I had a perfect opportunity, Gary, to kind of hedge a bit, try this for 6 months, liked it, and I think anybody who has travelled and been away for a while, you get to that inflection point where you've invested a couple of years overseas in a career, and to go further into that career, you kind of know instinctively that you're going to be here potentially for the rest of your days.
Yeah.
Right. And, at the time, it was post 9/11, things were quite unsettling in New York and in the States and globally, I suppose.
Were you living in New York during that time?
Yeah. And, dislocated because of 9/11, because of, where I lived was quite close to the World Trade Center, so I was kind of out of my apartment for a couple of weeks, which is a weird experience. But you do reflect on things like quality of life, and Ireland was buzzing at the time, and you it was kind of pre 2008, pre that collapse, and it was a fun place to come home, and I think a couple of years away, you tend to kind of recalibrate in your own head, that actually it's a good country to live in, it's small, and you kind of find when you land the plane after being in Manhattan, you kind of see, oh, all the buildings are a lot lower, and it does almost subconsciously lower your horizons a bit, but there's a huge upside in terms of quality of life. So yeah, look, all those things are wrapped around your head, and you just make a punt on it.
Did you have a plan when you were coming home? I like the way you had a couple of different ways of de-risking that. I think a lot of great entrepreneurs, that they're classed as these crazy risk takers because it's sexy, right? It's a good narrative to give people. Oh, he's this reckless, blah, 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 burn the boats. But in reality, most people I talk to, and all the good entrepreneurs I've talked to, they're calculated risk takers. They're able to take on the risk that might be above most people, but they've already got a plan. They've already gone, okay, I'm not going to burn everything down here. I've got a plan if this doesn't work or there's another way around it. So your story is, it's unique in the fact that you came from one industry to another. It's very similar to a lot of stories about
I think most people do. I think most sensible people do that arithmetic in their heads. They do qualified risk. And, I think your appetite for taking a higher risk profile, I think that you do need to take, it's not risk-free. I will never claim to be complete vanguard sort of Klondike, threw it all behind and ran into the hills and gave it a lash. No, there's definitely a conservative part of my makeup to do that assessment. Right. I think that's testament to most people. I think your observation is correct.
What were the early days of switching industries like? Because that can be a jarring experience when you come from one probably a pretty traditional industry in Wall Street to this, and digital back then was probably this great new ocean of opportunity. What was that like? Was the early days tough?
I had a little bit of an expose because I was working in the M&A part of JP Morgan. So I was actually assessing and running a kind of slide rule on a lot of acquisitions for Web 1.0. So I kind of had a broad macro view of the web as it was, or .com as it was back then, and it just seemed like the place to go. It just seemed like this is a whole new industrial revolution, and I want part of this. Maybe just being a little bit of an Irishman, banking in New York, certainly at that point in time, I'm sure things have changed. It's quite conservative, it's quite male, it's quite dare I say red state, and there's certainly a culture in there that is, I wouldn't say was wholly what I was about. So that adjustment coming out of a very structured, hierarchical kind of financial services I suppose, industry where, you know, a huge amount of presentism, Gary, you know, a huge amount of your life is devoted. It's very vocational, right? So, you know, it's almost this sort of, there's a little bit of toxic masculinity in it. Like, if you're not there at 4 o'clock on a Saturday, this, you're not pulling the hard shift, you know, even though you may just simply be just mooching around the place. So that moving away from that type of world, despite all the financial attractiveness of that, like huge monetary benefits of staying in that world, whether you stuck with what I was pursuing, which is financial analysis, or moving into trading per se, you know, huge upsides, right, from a kind of a monetary perspective, but at a big cost. So the move from that, from a personal point, I'm not saying that not moving into banking is for some people, and, you know, not in any way kind of belittling that. It's a hard life. It's a hard life, you know, people party hard, they work hard, everything you've seen in the movies, you know, a lot of that was there, you know, and more, you know, Wolf of Wall Street is not completely fabric, you know, and you kind of project yourself out and go, you know, do I want to be that, you know, that guy in Long Island, you know, with all that sort of, all that stress in your system. So the move into a small agency in Dublin in the early 2000s, it was completely flat. Nope. You know, you're on your own. You know, it was a tonic, really, you know.
Take me back to the early days then. What was it like coming back and then getting going? What year was this?
Yeah, 2002. And the company had overextended itself, had taken on too much staff against, I don't know if you recall, but there was a number of notable companies that had spun up in that early round of internet companies and internet service providers and agencies at the time who had overextended, and some notable ones that just didn't trade out of it. And Strata 3, as it was, the company had, you know, too many staff against the book. So, yeah, the first couple of months was rationalizing and letting people go, you know.
Right.
It was very unglamorous. It was about trying to steady the ship, get to a trading position, turn it from loss-making into profitability. And, yeah, that first year or two, myself and the chairperson worked very hard to tidy it up. We felt that there was a really good team in the middle of it. You know, oftentimes it's easier just to kind of collapse a business and start over. We just felt that there was a lot of loyalty in the team, and even though commercially it needed to be tightened up, there was a huge client loyalty, some great clients. So we just decided, you know what, let's dog it out, let's stick with this entity and try and fix it as opposed to start again.
Was there a couple of core values you went back to? Did you have a kind of a roadmap in mind as you're looking down the road? Had you a couple of things you were kind of going, right, if we can get it back to these, we'll be okay?
Yeah, I think we moved very quickly from, you know, one-off sort of project, fixed price, you know, moved straight into kind of long-term engagements, and just purposely, you know, moved away from clients that were just kind of incremental type clients, and really lowered the number of clients down to kind of core partner clients, where we really kind of appealed to the kind of the long-term benefits on both sides of the client agency relationship. And, you know, I think that saw us navigate us out of it in a very sensible way. So that made the business a lot more predictable. And, you know, we could hire and plan and get into kind of proper budgeting and forecasting quite early on after that phase. So, yeah, we kind of got into early, you know, time material engagements, you know, committed roadmaps, kind of embryonic kind of transformational type work. And then we kind of started to bring in a couple of smart people into the business to start to really kind of move into some of the strategy and consulting aspect of it. And as I touched on earlier on, you know, some of the people that came in that then subsequently became really interested in the analytics side. So, yeah.
It
was moving away from incremental work into kind of retainer type work was the first thing.
So that's 20 years in the digital space. You must have seen a massive amount of trends come and go and then come back again. What were the early trends that you guys kind of saw coming and then were able to leverage?
You know, in many ways, the first phase of some of this I've kind of netted out, Gary, just
the trauma of it.
a defensive mechanism. You know, there was a lot of emphasis on, you know, what they call eye candy and hyper design and movement, you know. And again, what we have been associated with is we're very we're kind of straight shooters in our firm, and we kind of tell it as it is, and we kind of like to have proof points. So we talked about the evolution of the company in the last couple of years, but I think it's always been in us to kind of move away from visual, you know, visually pretty stuff. I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive, but you know, what we were really trying to lean into, and some of our early clients were in banking, some of our early wins in the new phase of Strata 3 was, you know, really help clients kind of with their kind of their business goals. So so where we kind of got away from was really sort of visually rich, flashy sites that just commercially were just not at the races. So we kind of, a lot of our peers moved into kind of very visually rich stuff. We didn't, you know, it was very much about business systems and business, which is, dare I say, less sexy at the time. But so that trend has moved. And then over the course of the subsequent decade, you know, stuff that I would have seen and observed in some of the agencies in the US and in London, such as user experience and considered and almost that engineering approach to digital systems started to come into play, thankfully, as opposed to design, pure aesthetic design, which comes after. So yeah, so the next sort of decade in the kind of the mid 2000s or 2010s onwards was, you know, definitely the industry maturing, agencies starting to recognize that and clients starting to recognize that you need to build stuff that actually has a function and has a purpose for end users. Otherwise they won't come back and they won't use it again. So that started to kind of evolve in. And I suppose laterally over the last couple of years, the stuff that's really starting to become kind of front and center of what the world we live in is the concept of digital experience, where you don't think in a kind of an app or a website context solely. So, you know, you just think about an overall digital experience. So, you know, whether you go into a retail experience and you interact with an app either before or after, and then you're interacting with something in store, it all feels the same. It's this, there's a kind of almost a cognitive dissonance there. You know, there's no cognitive dissonance. It all feels part of the same experience. If you interact with a chat or you interact with, you know, a checkout flow or you book something through a Deliveroo, that type of everything blended. Mm. It's much harder to articulate this, by the way. It's much fuzzier, you know, kind of blended world.
You don't even notice you're doing it. It's just there. It just works. It's how I describe all great digital experiences. You're like, this just works. There's the friction. I was chatting to someone about this last week. Friction. It's everywhere in digital. A lot of digital experiences, especially if companies are trying to go rapidly in the last couple of years, they might have been mainly offline and now they're trying to get into online. And that friction you're having between the experience of, oh, well, you can order, but you can't pick it up in the shop, but you can do it between these hours and that hours. Now, COVID has brought a lot of that on. Has removing the friction and that kind of blending of worlds, has that been a lot of your focus?
Yeah, and I'm mindful to your audience that some of this stuff can feel really abstract, right? Mm. But they're really smart companies. The ones that are really going to win in the future are really thinking about this stuff, okay? So if you know, whether it's, setting up a new service through an app or installing a new piece of hardware or setting up your audiovisual or your home broadband, you know, that the experience you experience through that kind of initial setup and the experience you interact with on your TV, all of those things feeling identical and no friction, as you said, that's hard, right? Mm. To try and get all that feeling the same, right, in terms of the sale, the service, or the after sale, or the returns, or whatever the context is, the brands that are taking the time to curate that and to think about the small little corrective things to make that feel seamless are the ones that are going to win. Because it feels really natural. It feels really organic. It doesn't feel like an imposition. It feels like you're in control as the end user. And that seems like a very obvious thing to say, but a lot of organizations aren't thinking that way. They're thinking very siloed. They're thinking, we've got to launch an app to enable customers to set up a new TV broadband, but they don't think about the billing experience, or they don't think about the navigation or the UX on the actual screen. They're missteps, right? And, you know, brands and notable ones, you know, in the consumer space, really curated brands like Apple, in fairness to them, you know, and some of the brands that are really moving into D2C, you know, that traditionally would have sold through wholesale. I'll come to that theme in a minute. You know, they've thought about this stuff. And that's where we're leaning into in All Human, in our company, is to use that method I described, Gary, to ask users what they want, test concepts with them before launch it, and then test it live. And at each of those kind of three stages, you pick up little micro insights. You go, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, I missed that. And those little tiny credits, it's almost like the sporting analogy of the percentage game. There's no silver bullet. It's just loads of micro interventions and micro corrections. And, you know, some people say, oh, it's a pain in the ass. You have to do that. It seems like heavy lifting. It actually isn't. If you set up a process and you have it, you know, you build that sort of kind of rhythm of doing it. And the return investment is quite significant in terms of purchase, returning, loyalty, upsell, cross-sell. And we track all those metrics. And they're the hygiene factors that successful companies that are really, really switched on. Because if you think about it logically, I touched on this earlier on, if you don't do that and you don't curate a Gary Fox experience, you know, that feels like a Gary Fox experience, you know, I'm being facetious here, but like if it doesn't feel like a Guinness experience, or it doesn't feel like
it jars you. You can't explain it. Maybe you can't even say why you didn't enjoy something. It just jars. You kind of go, oh, that's not how people hate to be surprised in a bad way. People love being surprised in a good way, hate to be surprised in a negative way, where you're like, oh, that completely jars on what I've experienced so far with the brand.
Yeah. And it's almost like the brand almost needs to be in the background. The brand experience needs to be in the background. So it's almost like that worked. I don't want to think about it. People are time poor, and people are kind of brand promiscuous, as we call it. They jump around, and if they feel like, you know what, this taxi app is clunkier than the next one, I'll jump onto the next one. And this one that now works, and, you know, payments are easy and roundups are easy, and, you know, the navigation and all the interactions feel really easy, I will continue to use this. And, you know, to get those little micro insights or those larger insights takes time and method. And I suppose that's, in a really long-winded way, I'm trying to explain to you that what we've found is that if you take that massive of classic market research techniques and you combine it with analytics, it kind of becomes the greater than the sum of its parts.
I get you.
And that's at the heart of what All Human is about. It's about understanding real humans and designing stuff for that.
So you take kind of knowledge and insights from all different areas and kind of combine them together. How do you actually ask people? I might seem like a really silly, obvious question, but how do you actually get these insights from people?
It's a mixed bag. Sometimes it's surveys. Sometimes it's one-to-one interviews. Sometimes it's about actually designing stuff in a kind of a vacuum and putting in front of, panels based on assumptions, and then testing, you know, A's and B's and multivariate testing. So it's a mix of those things, Gary, and you know, it's remarkable what you find out in those interviews and those kind of surveys. It's quite revealing. That's really energizing what you find, you know, from users, because they're a font of knowledge and they're not asked often enough. And as I said earlier on, when we're working with some brands, really household brands that operate at an international level, like proper blue chip brands, you would be shocked at the paucity of research that's specific to digital products. Quite often it is originated research for a offline context. It might be just a classic piece of retail profile of a target user or assumptions around buying intent. And from that, you know, the assumption is that this can be used and extrapolated into digital context, but it can't. It's a different user experience.
I'm almost hesitant to bring up COVID. I think we're all a bit tired of talking about it, but I think it would be remiss of me not to ask you, because I would imagine from the outside looking in, I would imagine COVID has reshaped how people interact with digital products and digital brands. And I would imagine there's been a huge amount of change in the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I think probably for the positive. I think, you know, certainly since lockdown has eased off, or, you know, we're kind of, you know, post, although hard to know now with the recent numbers, but, you know, there's been a little bit of a snapback, kind of an anti-digital kind of reaction. But, you know, digital, you know, what we don't use the word digital transformation, but like digital adoption has been happening for quite some time. We all know that. But, you know, COVID was kind of an accelerant. It was petrol in the fire, you know, and a lot of organizations that were thinking about it adopted it, and those that were already doing it invested further. And you know, there's significant new behaviors that have emerged that, you know, for organizations like us in the middle of all this, really interesting, in the sense that, you know, delivery to home, parts of delivery, convenience, food ordering, the whole direct to consumer, that whole nexus of what happens in your home and where digital plays on that has just been supercharged, you know. You know, a lot of what we do is in that space, you know. Like, we're working with brands like, you know, on Post, and they're doing some really cool stuff in parts of delivery, in terms of track and trace, how that flows then into kind of purchase occasion, you know. And it's all new behaviors that people didn't really think they'd do in the past, you know. But your home has become a kind of a postal sorting office now for everybody. And, you know, it's just the world is coming to your gaff, unlike ever before. So that's obviously something we've all experienced. And, you know, even those that don't do fulfillment to home, you know, we've observed a lot of inbound inquiries to our business for, you know, trying to overhaul systems or apps or products that just were not really at the races. So, yeah, it's definitely been a positive time for us. And obviously I'm mindful of the sensitivity around it being a pandemic, and it's not in any way to be cynical, but yeah, it's definitely moved things towards digital investment.
It's not cynical at all. It's just the realities of the world we live in. You know, business has to continue. People still have to earn. To ask you further on that point, for entrepreneurs that are listening, what should they be looking at now within their businesses from a digital standpoint? What are the core things that you're seeing coming to the fore that they need to be cognizant of?
Well, I think it goes back to some of the themes I touched on. You know, when you are investing, and the types of organizations that we work with typically are already invested in digital, Gary, you have to start, particularly at leadership level, start to ask yourself some big questions. You know, are you getting bang for buck? Are you getting a return on investment for the marketing or for the digital marketing or for the search spend that you've invested in, firstly? Second questions that I would be asking, and we ask regularly, is what's the digital quotient internally within your organization? How digitally savvy is your own leadership team who are making these decisions within your organization? And I suppose the third thing then is back to the broader themes that I was touching on, is invest in research, invest in understanding the users that you think want to interact with your products and services at a really textured micro level, because you get huge upside from that. And once you've done that, all the kind of decisions around investment, technology, they all cascade out of that. You don't make those technology decisions or P&L decisions first. You really understand what does it look like. And then, I suppose, not to be a shock jock here, you know, if you don't do that, there's a kind of a, we call it the kind of the reckoning. We have a kind of a hunch, and it's probably corroborated by a couple of other peers in our industry, that organizations that don't make that investment now to kind of mark out their own customer base, their own loyalty, they're going to be outgunned. And, you know, a lot of organizations are going to see revenues really fall, or they're just going to become really commoditized. You know, how do you differentiate yourself as a health insurance provider or as a travel insurance provider in the future, you know, when it becomes a race to the bottom and it's very much price led? So what are you going to do to keep your customer base aligned to your brand or your proposition in digital context if you don't understand what your users want?
That's a really good point in terms of when your potential market is everywhere. As in, you know, it used to be like, oh, well, I get it from the local shop. Now it's like, well, I go online. We can get it from anywhere now, because the issue is, it's, you're no longer limited by barriers. So I think that's a really good point, that you're now competing with everybody. So if you're competing with everybody, well, what's the most unique thing about you? Like, if that's what you're really thinking about, what broader trends are you noticing and have noticed, say, in the last couple of years that are now coming to the fore? You've touched on some of them there in terms of logistics. But what else do business owners and entrepreneurs need to be cognizant of coming into kind of the new world?
Well, certainly, I mean, people talk about AI a lot, and you know, it has its place. But you know, what we advocate a lot is that AI has its place to a point. And when you talk about value proposition or value for customers and customer retention, there's definitely still a place for human intervention. So, you know, one of the things that we've just, you know, one of the gotchas that we've observed is organizations think that, oh, well, I'll spin up a, you know, AI or machine learning as a kind of a frontline service engine. You know, it works to a point, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the technology is constantly evolving, right? But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, this idea that digital cannot exist as a funnel or as a box on its own. Digital now has matured into a much more complex esoteric thing. It's part of real world experience, as we talked about earlier on. And your AI and your chatbot and all those kind of new technologies kind of have to adopt the same principle that it's a bit of human and it's a bit of tech together in a kind of a synergistic way, as opposed to one or the other. Everyone knows that human manned or human resourced call centers are expensive things to run, right, at a large scale level. And to assume that you can swap that out for an AI chatbot is a fallacy, you know, because quite often, you know, particularly in complex e-commerce or whether it's something like an insurance product or a pension product or something that's kind of a higher order complex up the value chain, that's never going to be replaced by AI. So that's just one thing to watch out for. And you could do here, it's very in vogue that, you know, AI and machine learning are kind of the new wave of digital. It has its place, but it needs to be curated and thought about in a considered way.
I love that, human intervention. It's the perfect, you've illustrated it perfectly. You know, digital is incredible. I'm very digital first. I love brands that are digitally led, but equally there's sometimes you just need the answer to the question, and it can't be given to you by a chatbot. There's a nuance there, I think, that humans can understand and bring you through human intervention. I think I love the new name, by the way, All Human. It really for a digital first company, it really symbolizes exactly what you've just explained there.
Yeah, and I suppose we're trying to kind of we're trying to be very, very clear in how we articulate what we do. We have a process that I talked about a few times now on this conversation, which is about trying to systematically identify what is going to help you to win, right? Long-term and short-term, because it's anchored against what real people want. I suppose for us, there's other humans in the mix. There's the humans on our clients. They're also humans, and they have business challenges and stresses and threats and competitive difficulties. So, you know, when we work with organizations, you know, at a fairly senior level, you know, they're really ambitious and they would really want, you know, we have growth targets or we have new acquisition sales targets or we want to create extra, you know, uplift in market share. They're difficult business goals that you want to achieve. And so for us, we're very much thinking about those human. What are the, how do you take those business KPIs and translate them into a set of digital metrics that you can win? And when we try and break down that language a little bit into plain business speak, it's about revenue growth in the channels. It's about cost deflection from traditional distributed channels like call center. So you can compare A and B. And again, I suppose maybe it's a little bit back to my old career of, you know, kind of crunching the numbers and looking at in a really business centered way. And, you know, I suppose, you know, at the core of All Human, our mission statement is, you know, we designed successful business products that people love. And you can have that business success and that sort of design that they're not mutually exclusive. So you can do both if you're sure-footed. So, and the other humans in our mix are our team. You know, like for us, you know, it's a really calm sort of, insofar as it can be in remote world, but it's a pretty honor trust kind of culture. We have a really, you know, we've really grown over the last 2 years, and you know, we have a real mix and it's not lip service, a really diverse mix of people, age profile, you know, overseas. It's a really interesting sort of, I suppose, mix of people or bunch of humans. So yeah, I suppose the rebrand is very much about getting back to, you know, in many ways, to humanize digital stuff. You know, it's in a really sensible way, in a really kind of honest way.
I love it. I have one final question for you. I ask every guest who comes on to recommend a book that's kind of made an impact on them personally, or they've just enjoyed it personally. What one would you recommend?
Yeah, so I suppose maybe just the nerd in me, I would have always had a real grasp for the, you know, things like the evolution of, you know, aviation and flight, and, you know, right up to the moon landings. And I got the opportunity when I was in college to listen to Neil Armstrong, and he did an interview in the National Concert Hall. Can't remember what year it was, in the mid 90s. It always struck me that he was just a really cool guy. So a book I read. James Hansen's book First Man a couple of years back. It was made into a movie recently with Ryan Gosling. A really good movie, actually. And it's just a really interesting book on a number of levels. So, you know, it tracks the technical effort at a kind of a, you know, real, dare I say, human level, but to take all those constituent suppliers and all of that technology and all of that industrial effort into one focused thing. And then the second thing that's really resonant in the book is just him as a guy. You know, he's quite an amazing human. Apart from the fact that he was the first guy to the moon, he was an engineer. He was a guy who in many ways I feel is kind of underplayed in terms of a historical figure. He was just one of these guys who was able to fly a plane, but had the calmness to do things under phenomenal stress. I mean, you know, he was involved in some early program. I think it was the Gemini program, which is about kind of moving things around and docking and all that kind of the building blocks of the space program. And something went wrong, and he was able to, he just didn't black out. I mean, he just had this kind of, whether it was genetic or it was just, he was coded that way. So there was a calmness in him. And I think the third thing that kind of came out of the book that I really enjoyed was, I suppose, the humanity of the guy, you know. The subject matter of this interview is entrepreneurs, and often entrepreneurs are very devoted, singular, focused people, and that comes at a cost, whether it's familial or friendship. You know, you drive a business inexorably in a direction to growth, as do I. But in the case of Armstrong, what came across was that everything he achieved, there was a cost. You know, there was a cost to his family. You know, he broke up with his wife. He had tragedy in his life. So yeah, that's a book that left a, you know, it was a bit of history, personal struggle, phenomenal global story. So yeah, First Man, I recommend that as a real all around read. It's not one of these sort of right stuff, hyper macho things at all. It's actually really, really it's quite a beautiful piece of biography.
Love it. We've done hundreds of episodes at this stage, and I love when we get a fresh recommendation. So we've never had that one, First Man. John, that was brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing. Where can people learn a little bit more about All Human?
Yeah, check us out on allhuman.com. And again, you know, as an Irish agency, a very proud Irish company, the .com for us was a sign of intent. Our plan is to really grow the business overseas. And, you know, we're winning business overseas in the US and in other regions. So allhuman.com, you get to see some of our casework. You can track us on LinkedIn as well. To bring our proposition to life, you know, there's a phone number there. You can ring us up and we will talk to you as humans.
Talk to a real life human. John, thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure, Gary.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with John. Go to social media. Follow me, Mr. Gary Fox, MR Gary Fox, and tell me what lesson you took away from today's chat. I really loved John's insight about why people are coming into the office now. So if they're coming in, they need to be doing something that's human focused, not just sitting on their laptop. I really took that away and it stayed with me. I'll see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab.